it's hard to make deals pencil. I use a debt service coverage requirement, and that is hard to hit when rents aren't able to meet the debt service coverage requirements. I have to ask for more equity, and it's a challenge for a lot of these investors right now to get deals to pencil.
You're a working professional, but struggling to balance the workload of your career, family, obligations, and preparing for your financial future? If so, this podcast is for you. You've spent years learning your craft, and now it's time to focus on your financial future. This podcast will teach you what you need to retire wealthy and happy. Let's dive in.
It takes a whole village to raise a child. Good Lenders are one of the behind-the-scenes members of The Village that helps our real estate investments grow and develop. On today's show, we get to learn from Andrew Baroff.
Welcome to the Retire Wealthy, Retire Happy podcast. We're excited to have Andrew Baroff here with us today. Ben has lost his voice, or at least he was mostly lost it earlier. He says it's come back a little bit, so we're going to have him in and out today. If he throws up his hands and says, Earl, you got to take over, we'll do that. When I thought he wasn't going to be here, I figured, well, we'll just talk about the cats are away, the mice will play, so I guess I'm on my own and I can do what I want today. But it sounds like he's going to be here watching and keeping an eye on me anyway, so there we go.
Just a quick reminder to our listeners, this show is to provide financial tips and tricks to help you build up passive income, and also to provide methods that you can use to protect your wealth so that you can plan a better future for yourself and your family. We're grateful to have this podcast sponsored by Monument Real Estate Capital. Monument Real Estate Capital, helping you retire 10 years early through real estate investments.
So we're excited today. We've got a good friend, Andrew Baroff, that's here with us today. Now, Andrew, I'm pretty sure that we met the first time out at the Adam Adams seminar back in 2019 out in Denver. I know we traded cards while we were out there. That was an incredibly fun event, by the way. I don't know how you felt about it, but I've been to a number of seminars and we love Adam. And in fact, he's the one that's doing the editing on these podcasts for us. But we traded cards out there. You're in my contact with a note from there. And then I think you came to an event. I was speaking probably Apartment Obsessions, if I remember right, that you came, talked about markets and that type of thing. And then last year, we're at a closing. And I got to tell you, one of the only lenders that I know of that shows up at a closing for those things. But we sit there across the table and there you are, reached out going, hey, man, good to see you. We talked to Paul just a couple last week. We had Paul on, talked about it. And that was the smoothest loan that I think I've ever done. Everything just as smooth as could be. I think the only hiccup was the closing, as we're sitting there around the closing table, wondering where documents are for us to sign. They were supposed to come out of New York somewhere. But other than that, that was a very, very smooth transaction. So we really, really appreciate your work on that. Andrew's a commercial mortgage lender. He's also an active real estate investor. And what do we want to do? Andrew, I'm going to turn some time over to you and have you tell us a little bit about your background, how you got started in mortgage lending, and we'll go from there.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being on your show today. Thank you for having me.
We're really excited. So,
yeah. So I started in banking in 1998. I worked my way up the ranks. In 2004, I started doing commercial real estate lending, SBA lending, and it's really taken off from there. Switched over to a commercial bank, and from there, I got into some special asset workouts and things like that. And then in 2011, I did some originations from 2007 to 2009, and then 2011, I came back from doing workouts and started doing originations in 2013 with the organization with now. It's been a great ride, and I've learned a lot over the years. I've learned the relationships are where it's at, and it's been great to work with you guys and others like you. It's been rewarding.
One of the things that I think is made working with you different, we just closed on a loan about 6 weeks ago, and it was interesting because the guy that underwrote the loan looked at my financials and he said, Klein, you lost $2 million last year. How can we loan you any money? Did you look at it? It's a loss carry forward from depreciation on real estate. But it was interesting because he didn't understand that. We finally got through it. But that was just a huge hurdle because he'd been in banking for forever, never on the investing side of it. He didn't even understand how it was that was possible. And what I was going to say is we enjoyed about working with you was that you are also on the investing side. And so much of what we sent to you, you looked at it and go, this is reasonable. I don't even think you called me on my budget very much. So I always get called on my budgets and stuff like that. But it was very helpful to have somebody that's like, yep, I've seen this before. I know what they're doing. I know, that I can see their plan. And that's what made the thing go really, really smooth. So I appreciate that.
So in 2018, I saw the benefits that some of my borrowers were receiving from real estate investing. And I thought, I got to do this. And so I started the process, created my own LLC, and just started learning. And yeah, I mean, exactly what you said, I understand where the tax returns, I understand how these investors work and what they do, with their investments. And it's easy for me to underwrite a deal because I can see those things and I've experienced those on my own. I'm investing, and it's not a surprise to me.
Andrew, when you're doing real estate investing for yourself, do you prefer to be a limited partner or a general partner?
Yeah. I don't mind being a limited partner if I'm with the right group. I have done that. I am a limited partner on a couple of deals. General partner, I do like doing that as well. I think there is some upside for being a general partner. If I can be a general partner, that's the way I'd like to go. I guess it just depends on the situation where I'm at. Usually if I have somebody to invest, then limited partner's not a bad idea. There's a lot of great operators out there like you guys are.
Thank you for that. And could you share some details about some of your favorite deals that you've been involved in?
Yeah. So as an investor, there's a property we purchased as a partnership in Cambodia, MSA. It's a 54-unit apartment complex. We bought it with the idea of raising rents to, I think our projected rents were $975. They're all two-bedroom units, and we ended up getting, we're getting now about $1,300, been able to get the rent. So we bought it. The way we found it, some partners found it. They were calling owners, and were able to find it. And we bought it at the perfect time. It was right as we're, it was, 2021, so right before things really started, inflation started kicking in, so we're able to get it for a good price, and then we're able to ride the increase in rents.
And that sounds a lot like our Whispering Sands, Vermont property, doesn't it? We pro forma to what, $700-$800 a month. We ended up hitting $1,000, and it looks like we can hit $1,200 if we push it a little bit.
Andrew, is that supposed to be more of a long term project, or is that more of a short term renovation and sell?
Yeah, so we renovated that within about 18 months, and then we're able to refinance the loan, pull 95% of the cash out. Payback investors, and then got on a long-term loan. We'll probably hold it long-term, I think, at this point. And we could probably sell it for a lot more than, for quite, and get some good returns if we sell. But I think the plan right now is just to hold it and enjoy that cash flow.
That makes sense. And are you a limited partner or a general partner in that one?
I'm a general partner in that one.
Okay. Do you have any limited partner stories you want to share with us?
Well, let's see. I can tell you the first one that I did, and it was also this operator's first deal. It's not a great story, but it was a learning experience. They got in. It was 55 units total, two buildings. They were able to, I guess they got in and started renovating, but they weren't really able to get the units leased like they wanted. And they were able to sell it, and were able to get, I think, 15% return on that one. But it just wasn't what they expected. It was a quick turnaround, I guess. And then but the same operator, this time I invested with them again, and they have a much better track record now. They've been able to cycle through, I want to say, 10 or 12 projects, and their equity multiple on those is 1.5 to 2 times. So the other deal I just mentioned, the first one, they were able to get, I think, 1.2 equity mark. Super awesome. But going forward, I think we've got some really great opportunities where we'll be able to get that 2 times equity multiple in about a 3-year period of time.
Do you know what was causing them not to be able to get the rents they wanted?
I think it was just property managers. I think they cycled through several property managers, just weren't doing their job. And it's a smaller property, so their economies of scale weren't great. And I think sometimes when it's a smaller property, the property managers don't spend as much time on them. They give the attention that they ought to. I think that was the issue, cycling through different property managers and not really getting the traction they needed.
Well, it's just something interesting to consider, right? Because there's a lot of real estate investment opportunities out there, and the numbers can say whatever somebody wants them to say. But when we come to the real world, it's not always possible or easy to hit those numbers. And obviously, experience plays a big role into that. Sometimes there's things outside of our control, such as market factors or whatnot. But making sure you are working with a team that has experience and is able to operate to produce the financials that they projected is a really important deal. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Going forward, you know, anytime I'm going to invest with someone, I think I want to see a good track record, and you know, they can show me, you know, what they've been able to do, what kind of equity multiple they've been able to deliver consistently over time. Newer operators, and there's a lot of risk. You can maybe get in, or you can get on some of those smaller deals with them, but I think for now, and for me, I think I want to go with, you know, more experienced operators like you guys. And Earl, you've been doing this a long time. you've cycled through quite a few units, I think, haven't you?
I have all the gray hair to prove it, or lack of it anymore. I've been doing, and unfortunately for me, I started in property management, which meant I had all the headaches, all the toilets plugged on Christmas Eve to deal with, and all the things that we joke about with property management. And I collected a salary that was, you know, it was a decent salary, but nothing that I would get too excited about today. So had long, long time, a lot of gray hairs, really, really glad to be on this side of the equation and grow my financial wealth a little bit faster than doing it from the property management standpoint. Although I wouldn't trade that for anything in the world. The experience that I got today, and it's interesting, we sit down and talk with people and they just assume because of all my experience that we're actually going to do a good job. We get a lot of credibility up front. How's that? It works well for us. Property management, you're not on the investing side. You're not putting your money into a project. You're managing it for somebody else. And then you get all the headaches and hassles, but you don't get the reward. When you're on the other side, you're raising money and putting the deals together yourself. I still get quite a bit of the hassle and headache, but at least I've got a property manager that we hire to buffer that a little bit for us. But the financial reward on the investing side are really a lot greater than being on the property management side. How's that?
There's a lot of ways you can make money in real estate, and it's important that you understand the differences so that you can really reap the benefits of certain ownership aspects of real estate.
Yeah, and you know, we talk all the time with people about the first thing to invest in is yourself. And anybody wanting to get started to learn to do what it is that we do, I would strongly recommend that they spend a little bit of time on that side of it, because you get paid a decent salary to do it and you get a chance to invest in yourself, and you'll know when you're ready to make that leap, you know.
Well, I imagine the property management helped you in your underwriting. You're able to see where rents need to be to make it work. I imagine that helped a lot.
I've had a number of deals where people have brought them to me. I looked, I ran the numbers based on what the owner sent me in the financials. And because of those years of looking, reading financials and knowing where they should be, I've had deals that literally nobody else could make them work. And I don't mean nobody, but they were passed around to a number of people that looked at them and said, I can't make this deal. And usually the culprit is the seller was doing a small rehab, and he was putting his rehab expenses or in the operating expenses. So, of course, they bloat the operating. And no matter how much you raised the rent, you couldn't overcome the fact that they were paying way too much in expenses. And so, absolutely, it's one of the things that I'm able to do is look at something and go, oh my gosh, this is where the problem is right here. And even though they're operating it at $1,200 a unit, I'm going to operate it at $500 or $600 when we get it fixed up and cleaned up. And that is usually enough to make the difference between being able to do those deals and not do those deals. And so again, everybody has to get started what feels comfortable for them. But I will be forever grateful for the time that I spent doing a little bit of property management just for that exact reason. It gives you kind of a vision of what you can do and what you can't do. I might not sleep at night if I was doing some of the pro formas that we're doing if I hadn't actually walked them through a few times before, because some of the stuff we seem to pro forma would be out there a little bit, right, Ben?
Absolutely. But that's the point of having the experience. You know what actually is going to play out.
So, Andrew, I want to touch base a little bit. I'm going to ask you a little bit about the programs that you currently offer. And I know the company that you work for, they're a little bit different in their approach. What do you think makes them different? What's unique about the stuff that you bring to the table there?
Well, I think it's just that there's a difference in the way I approach deals. And I think some of the things that I offer are not really seen a lot in the banking world, like a one-time close. There's some lenders out there, banks in general, they'll have a construction loan and say they offer a three-year construction period with options to extend. I'll offer like a one-time close where, you know, they don't have to worry about those extensions. They can just get in, renovate the property. It converts to a long-term loan once it's stabilized, and they can just forget about it. So I think there's some of those, you know, that's one example I feel like I can offer, and I try to do that wherever, you know, whatever lender I'm working with.
So the construction to perm is really what you're talking about, is a construction to perm type of a loan? In today's entire environment, that's got to be incredibly valuable for a developer trying to get a project off the ground. And they're sitting here going, interest rates are at 6.5 right now, but what if they're at 9 by the time we finish this thing in 2 years? What am I going to do? Because the deal probably wouldn't pencil. That kind of stuff is incredibly valuable when you've got somebody. And that's what we noticed with the deal that you did with us. It was structured and tailored to meet what we needed, right? It was kind of a hybrid. It's a semi-permanent loan. Technically, it could be permanent, but at a reasonable interest. It had an interest rate of a permanent loan, but you also loaned us a significant amount of the upfront money. So it performed kind of like a bridge loan also. Not the upfront, but the repair funds. So it operated a little more like a bridge loan too.
Yeah, it was a fixed rate initially, so you didn't have to worry about that. And it was good timing too, because rates went up quite a bit after that.
They did. Oh my goodness. Yeah, I would love to get a couple more loans. If you've got a couple that are sitting there on the shelf that you had rate locks on and somebody didn't fulfill, I'll just step in and take those over anytime now. So anyway, so where you're at, and you and I've talked about this before, how has the lending market changed in the last 6 months? Tell us about some of the things that you see changing.
Yeah, so as you're all aware, the Fed has raised rates quite a bit, 500 basis points since last year, and it's really shocked the market. What I'm seeing is a lot of investors are on the sidelines, not wanting to go forward with construction projects because they don't know where their rate's going to end up. What I'm seeing is, I think the treasuries have seemed to settle down a little bit, and that's good. Short-term rates are still on the rise. And so I think generally there is still some uncertainty, but I think things are getting better. Hopefully we don't see any more Fed rate increases so that things can kind of settle down. I think, you know, buyers and sellers, there's still been a gap there between, you know, what's expected in price versus what the buyers are willing to pay. Hopefully that's coming, you know, that gap is coming closer to where they can find some price discovery and start going forward on deals. So yeah, I mean, the lending environment has really changed a lot. There is some uncertainty and people aren't as willing to go forward with projects. And there are still deals being done though. There are still lenders out there that are going forward with deals, and you just have to kind of search for those and try and sync up with them and move forward.
When I've spoken in the past at REIA clubs and stuff, one of the cardinal rules that I always tell people is your cap rate needs to be 1% above whatever borrowing costs are. So when borrowing costs were 3.5%, you could buy a 4.5% cap rate. And sometimes people would squeeze that to a 4, or even I see people buy a cap rate equal to the borrowing costs, with the intention of raising the rents and growing into a little bit of a spread there. When interest rates are 6.5, and I know there's some quotes out there a little bit lower than that, but generally I think that's about where they are right now, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of rates around the mid-6s and even into the 7% range.
Okay. And so all of a sudden, your cap rate that used to be 4.5 or 5 is now 7.5. And sellers are just not wanting to. That's a huge, huge loss. A half a point in cap rate makes just a huge difference in the price. And you bring it up by 3 points, 3 on cap rate. And you do this, right? You know, the investing side of it. So talk a little bit about the buyers that are still in the market. How are they doing it?
That's a good question. Yeah. I mean, I talked to one investor and he said, you know, he wanted to see 2%, but he buys single tenant assets and he wanted to see 2% cap rate above the borrowing rate. I don't know if that's possible in the multifamily arena. Probably not. But that's really a good rule of thumb is to make sure your purchase price, your cap rate going in is much higher than the borrowing cost. So from what I've seen on the investing side, in the lending arena, yeah, it's hard to make deals pencil. I use a debt service coverage covenant requirement, and that's hard to hit when rents aren't able to meet the debt service coverage requirements. And we just, with those situations, we have to ask for more equity, and a challenge for a lot of these investors right now to get deals to pencil.
That DCR, debt service coverage ratio, could be your best friend and your worst enemy. My absolute favorite negotiating technique is I go in and put it under contract. I've got one where Ben and I are going back to Nebraska probably Monday. We're just waiting for the final signature on the contract to walk about 55 units back there. And I looked at the thing. We told them where we thought it would pencil. They came back and asked for a couple hundred thousand higher. I didn't even bat an eye. I said, oh, yeah, I'll pay the extra couple hundred thousand because it's subject to financing. And we're going to go back there and we're going to walk the unit. We're going to give them a list of everything that it needs. And we're going to say, by the way, while I'm back there, I'm going to submit it to a lender and they're going to give me a rate quote, right? And I'm going to go back to them and say, this is where this has to be to hit that 1.25 debt service coverage ratio. And if it doesn't hit it, then we got to talk about seller financing or something else to make those deals work. So I'm sure you're on the one side where you're hearing buyers moan and groan about debt service coverage ratio. And Ben's laughing, but that's our best negotiating tool, I think. And they can't argue with it. Nobody can argue with that because I'm taking their numbers that they gave me and just using current mortgage rates. We can argue all day long about cap rates and where it should be, and this is a better market and vacancy and all that kind of stuff. But nobody can argue with their operating numbers from last year. So anyway, that debt service coverage ratio, like you said, you have to have it as a lender. You can't possibly do a deal that's not going to pencil because none of us have that kind of money in our pocket to make those several thousand dollar a month mortgage payments. You were with us at the Best Ever Conference, and one of the speakers got up and said basically 20% of the syndicators probably wouldn't be in this space at this time next year. You were there, talked a little bit about it. Talk a little bit about how you see that playing out. Are you guys starting to see some loans come back? Is it still a ways out before? And we may not see them come back, right? But there's obviously, with rates increase, there's probably some people that are going to have trouble refinancing their loans because they were at low, low interest rates and lower cap rates, and they're not going to be able to refinance them. How's that working out?
So the reason why they're not going to be able to cover the debt, so they have variable rates. That's the issue, right? If they have variable rates, they're not going to be able to service the debt with the rents they're getting. I haven't really seen any issues like that, what I've been doing, but I know there are operators out there that don't have rate caps or they don't have fixed rate going in on their bridge loan or something like that. And they're going to have some issues for sure. And that's going to be a challenge for them. So like we talked already, it's good to, if you can, go in with fixed rate going in and then you don't have any issues. And the things I'm working on, there are certain triggers or things in place that are preventing any default. I haven't had to worry about that, but that's definitely an issue in the market right now. And these syndicators that didn't take precautions, didn't buy those rate caps, are definitely going to have some issues. I'm going to have to buy or sell or something to get out of those without losing the property.
How much has loan volume changed? Probably quite a bit, I'm guessing. But the volume of loans, how's it affecting the industry right now?
first part of this year that I think there's definitely been a slowdown for sure. I think things are picking up. You know, I'm seeing a lot more opportunities, but there was a slowdown with rates going up. It was just a shock to the market. And hopefully going forward here, we're going to have more opportunities.
Anything else about the mortgage market? What's going on that you see?
Well, I think it's just hopefully we can start to see buyers and sellers come together. You know, with hopefully rates are going to start settling down a little bit, not going up as much. And we're going to be able to see some deals getting done. From what I'm hearing, I don't think the Fed's going to drop their rates. I think they're going to hold for a while. So what does that mean for lending? I think maybe long-term rates will come down a little bit. You know, if lenders are using the treasuries, for example, maybe they're able to come down on rates there. But the short-term rates, if they're using short-term rates for construction or bridge financing, I don't think those are going to come down for a little while.
At least not until we get further into a full-scale election mode. And then it's amazing how interest rates seem to come down for about 6 months. As the group in power always wants to try and maintain power for as long as they can.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm going to ask you a little bit about personal balance. How do you, like most of our guests, you're still working and got a family, and how do you maintain balance in your life? What do you do to enjoy the other side of the fruits of your labor, so to speak?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think in my younger years, I definitely violated that. I worked a lot and I feel bad. I should have spent more time with family, but you know, in those years, I was focusing on trying to build my career and things. But I've learned over the years, it's really not worth it. You got to spend time with your family. You got to spend time with them. And that's the whole reason why I would do this. And for me, there's a certain time of day, I cut it off and say, I'm done. This is it. And I try to shut off work and not go back to that and do other things. And certainly, investing is part of that. I've got to spend time doing that to keep what I'm part of going. But yeah, there's just time of day, either start of day or end of day, where you just have to cut it off and spend time with those you love.
I'm at the point in my life, I'm old enough now, I keep looking at it going, I can't take a single dime of it with me to the other side. And I might just as well spend some of it, enjoy my time. You probably heard Roger and I were in Miami last week and then rented some bikes and went down to Key West and had an incredibly beautiful ride down there. So I'm at that point in my life where I could still work, but I'm enjoying a little bit more free time than I used to when I was to a desk 60 hours a week or whatever it was. So
yeah, the vacations are definitely, that's always there. And that's the thing too, with vacations even, it's easy to get sucked into work while you're on vacation. The way with phones and things, we have that information available and ability to access wherever we are. And that's something I've learned too, is just try to shut that off. It's hard, but it's important to spend time with family.
I downloaded too many videos just before I left, and it overloaded my hard drive on my laptop. So the second half of my trip, I wasn't able to use my laptop. So that kind of took care of that for a little while. I couldn't see my phone well enough to do very much work. And so there's the solution. Find a way to disable your laptop, even if it's unintentional, and you'll be able to enjoy the last couple of days of motorcycle riding or whatever.
Yeah, that's one way to do it.
Hey, Andrew, speaking of balance, we love having people like yourself on that work in the lending industry, but are also an investor themselves. So would you be willing to share with our listeners a little bit about your personal investing philosophy and what it is that you look for when you're investing in a project? And maybe our listeners can understand how they could apply that into their own life.
Yeah. So like we've already talked about, going in cap rates, that's important to make sure those going in cap rates are higher than the lending rate. That's one key metric I like to look at. Other key metrics, I just like to grab the spreads in the pro forma Excel spreadsheet that these investors are using to come up with their project. And I analyze that, and I can always tell, and I guess it takes experience, but I can tell where certain things are out of whack. Maybe they're increasing rents way too much in the first year. We're in a recessionary period or something, or in a pandemic, and we're just not going to raise rents like they say. Or there's certain things in there. The exit cap rate, that's another one. I look at that and make sure that that's not too excessive. I think some people use underwriting where they want to see at least 10 basis points per year, the whole period increase in cap rate for exit, maybe even more. Maybe it's 25 basis points. So those are some metrics. Also, I think as we've been talking, experience is a big factor. And people who have experience, like Earl and other people, I want to invest with them. Newer operators, it's a challenge for me now. I did invest here, and that investment didn't go so well. I want to make sure I'm investing in people who have experience, they know what they're doing, and they've been able to produce the returns I'm expecting year after year and investment after investment. Trying to think of other things I look at with underwriting. Rent growth versus expense growth. So I always want to see at least 2% increase in expenses per year. Some investors will match that with the rents. They'll have 2% increase in income as well as a 2% increase in expenses. That kind of flattens things out. So I don't know. There's just different things in those underwriting spreadsheets. And I think another key point, some sponsors don't want to share those spreadsheets with you when you invest, and it should be a red flag.
I agree with that. Thank you for sharing those thoughts. There's a lot to be considered when you're investing either on your own or with other people. And you brought up some really good points about things people should be looking for with those underwriting models.
Hey, you could probably hear my dog curled up under my desk and was really, really quiet. And all of a sudden, she's chasing some kid down the street. Not down the street, but in the window out the front of the house. She's out barking for a minute. But anyway, you talked about your underwriting methods and stuff like that. I always try to put my income going up. The first year income's different, but after that, you have to have a cost of living increase. I always try to increase my expenses. And a lot of people think that nets it out, right? If I increase my expenses by 2% and I increase my income by 2%, but it still makes the project grow because your expenses are typically only a third of what the total income is. So I can increase them and get a realistic expense, and it still grows at a small rate, just not at the same rate that the first year income growth that we're putting in there. So those make perfect sense to me as I'm sitting down. I think they're built into my model that we use. So it's always really fun to talk to somebody who has probably more insight in what's going on in the market than even we do. Right. Because you're there. And I know that you've got meetings with people who are watching the Fed and seeing what they're doing and all that kind of stuff. It's always great to get those kind of insights from someone who really watches those and knows exactly what's going on. And we really, really appreciate your insight. I know we've met together a couple of times and tried to get the inside scoop from you. So we appreciate that a lot.
Andrew, we're going to jump into the final four. These are four questions that we ask everybody that comes on our show. So, Andrew, would you be willing to tell us what your favorite business book is?
Favorite business book would be, well, I just got done reading Sell or Be Sold by Grant Cardone. That was a good one. I don't know if that's my favorite, but I'll say that.
Sounds good. Grant Cardone's got a lot of good information, so it's hard to go wrong with him. Andrew, tell us, what is it that brings you happiness?
I think relationships, being with people and, you know, helping people out, that really is rewarding to me, and seeing that those benefits, they last a lot longer than you may think. Helping people with projects, with things that they're working on, I think that's probably most rewarding to me, just being there for people and associating with people and getting to know people.
Thank you for sharing that. That's a common theme we're seeing when we ask people this question, so thank you. Tell us what your future retirement looks like.
Future retirement, I don't know if I will retire. If I'm not working a W-2 job, I'm still going to be doing stuff. I'm still going to be investing, and I may be in my 80s and still doing stuff. I don't know if there will ever be a retirement. You know, I'll probably spend a little bit more time doing some of the other things I like to do, but I'm still going to have my hands in deals and working on things and making money.
What are those other things you would do that you enjoy?
I like fishing. I like skiing. Cycling, you know, spending time with family. Golf is a good one. Takes a lot of time, but I like it.
All good leisure activities. Andrew, the last question today is, what do you think is the best way to give back?
Best way to give back. If you think about, maybe money is the best way to give back, and that is definitely helpful. But I think we all have talents and abilities that we can share. And giving of those is probably the best way to give back. Finding a need and then filling that need, whatever it is, keeping your ears open to the way, you know, to things that are going around that are needed.
Great ideas. Thank you for sharing that. Andrew, is there a good place for our listeners to find you online?
You can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Facebook. Those are probably the best places to find me.
We'll have those links in our show notes as well.
So we really appreciate the time you spent with us, and we know our listeners are going to get quite a bit out of it. We spent a little bit of time looking at your background. We spent quite a bit of time talking with you about the mortgage markets and where you see them headed, on some tips to underwrite their deals. And from somebody who looks at, you probably look at, I don't know more, but I know you probably look at as many deals as I do in a week. And so you can't look at that many deals and not get pretty good at seeing the errors of somebody's figment of their imagination, so to speak, with underwriting. But anyway, we really, really appreciate that. And then, you know, of course, the Final Four, it's always nice to get a little different perspective from our guests and books and what brings them happiness. By the way, the comment on what brings you happiness is your association with your family. We did an entire podcast on that one topic, and it was amazing how everything else, the money, the fame, all those things pale in comparison to our relationship with our families. And so I encourage everybody to do what you can to make the spouse happy, because it's probably not, it's not a lot better on the other side, so to speak. So anyway, once again, Andrew, we want to thank you for joining us on our Retire Wealthy and Happy podcast. It's been a real pleasure. We enjoy hanging out with you. We need to get up and take you to lunch one more time, and we really need to. We've got a couple of deals coming up. We've been talking about getting you to, including you in some of those and working with you on some of those. We look forward to doing some deals with you here in the future. And again, thanks so much for coming on and sharing with our listeners.
Thanks for your time, man.
It's a pleasure. I appreciate you having me on.
Hope you got value from this episode. And if you have a minute, then take the time to leave an honest written review for the podcast, because we take those reviews seriously, and it'll help us serve you better on the next episodes. And most importantly, be sure to start taking action so you can control your financial future today.